You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 29th of January 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Tom Edwards. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, immigration reform is a top priority for President Obama. But how comprehensive will it really be? And is this just politics playing out once again?
The demographics in this country show that the Hispanics are the fastest growing part of the electorate. Republicans know that if they don't do something to help themselves there, they could be doomed to irrelevance for generations to come.
We'll explore China's growing role in the world and how they're expanding in a bid to try and reshape the globe in the image of Beijing. And the Trevi Fountain is getting a makeover from the famed fashion house Fendi. We find out why the fountain is going upscale.
Italy has a lot of monuments, 47 UNESCO World Heritage Sites, so that they need to be upkept. And in times of austerity, money is not there from the state.
Plus, we'll head to Cologne to visit the world's largest sweets fair. And we find out whether big cultural or sporting events like the 2012 Olympics can affect the choices people make when it comes to buying dogs. All that, plus we play some music too, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. So, a fun-packed hour lies ahead. But before all of that excitement, let's catch up on the latest news from around the world with Paul Osborne.
Activists say the bodies of dozens of young men who had apparently been executed have been found in the Syrian city of Aleppo. At least 65 were found on the banks of a river. Most had their hands tied behind their backs. People have now started to gather at the scene, trying to track down missing relatives. French-led forces in Mali are preparing for an assault on the last rebel stronghold in the north of the country, Kidal. Yesterday, they took control of Timbuktu alongside Malian troops. Britain has said it will send more than 300 troops to Mali and neighbouring countries to help train local forces. Meanwhile, international donors have pledged hundreds of millions of dollars to boost efforts to tackle Islamist militants in Mali. The total was announced at the conference in Ethiopia by Ramtane Lamamra of the African Union.
I'm glad to report that the overall amount which was pledged today here reached the amount of 455.53 million US dollars.
President Obama is joining efforts to push through a change in U.S. immigration law. He's to set out a plan the day after a bipartisan group of senators said now is the right time for reform. They suggested a route to citizenship for millions of people in the U.S. A U.S. Senate committee has unanimously backed John Kerry to be the next Secretary of State. It's thought his formal confirmation as Hillary Clinton's successor will follow within hours. Senator Kerry was the losing candidate for president in George W. Bush's second victory in 2004. After the vote, he spoke about the important work still to be done.
Meeting with some folks who've just come back from the Middle East, and obviously the urgency of our efforts can't be overstated there and elsewhere. And this committee is going to be critical. Absolutely critical to putting America's best foot forward and helping us to hopefully make peace in places where it isn't.
The head of Egypt's army is warning the country is on the brink of collapse after days of violence and political unrest. Abdel Fattah al-Sisi was speaking after 5 days of at times violent protest against the president, Mohamed Morsi. At least 52 people have died. Tuesday has been quieter so far, though earlier a group of youths hurled rocks at police in Cairo's Tahrir Square. 21 people have been killed in a plane crash in Kazakhstan. The passenger plane crashed in thick fog as it approached the airport in the country's commercial capital, Almaty. It's the second fatal plane crash in Kazakhstan in a little over a month. Rescue teams in Australia are struggling to cope as flooding continues in the east of the country. More than 1,000 people had to be rescued in the city of Bundaberg after the Burnett River burst its banks. The city of Grafton in New South Wales is under threat as water levels in the Clarence River continue to rise. Murray Keir is from the State Emergency Service.
Well, this is the flood of record for Grafton. It has never been in recorded history this high. I think you have to go back to the 1890s to actually get a flood that's around the 7.7 metre mark. So now nearly 8.1, the largest flood that Grafton has ever seen.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Paul. It's 18.05 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, comprehensive immigration reform has been a serious issue that's remained unresolved in the US since the Reagan years. The last president to try and reform the system was George W. Bush in 2005. All that ended up happening then was a giant fence was built along the border. President Obama promised to initiate reforms during his first term, but it wasn't a battle he thought worth fighting. The picture, though, looks very different now, after a decisive election victory last year that saw the Latino vote side heavily with Democrats. One of the biggest hurdles has been what to do with the almost 12 million illegal immigrants already living in the United States and whether to give them a path towards citizenship. A little earlier, I spoke to Reed Epstein, White House correspondent with Politico. Reed is in Las Vegas, where the president is about to announce his plans for immigration reform in the next couple of hours. I started by asking Reed what we can expect from tonight's speech.
We expect to hear the president talk about his vision for immigration reform, how it, not necessarily a new vision, but it's reiterating what he has been for a couple of years, looking for a path to citizenship for people who are undocumented in this country, talking about how it's a piece with his vision of sort of the American dream and sort of his push for the middle class in this country trying to get ahead.
Now, people will obviously have been aware of this plan, this initiative that was mooted yesterday from a group of eight senators. I guess skeptics will say, look, what's going on with the timing of this? Why did they try and preempt the president? Was it to try and show that they've actually got their own momentum, that they can deliver, you know, legislation that we're likely to see brought forwards? What was going on with the timing of that announcement?
Well, yeah, it's sort of a classic Washington game of when something is rather inevitable, people start to scramble to get credit for it. And so what you saw yesterday was the senators not wanting to get left behind by an Obama plan, trying to put forward their own proposal in order to get that moving faster. The other issue is the Republicans who are involved in this, the Republican senators who are involved, it's much easier for them politically to be behind a plan that it's a bipartisan plan from the Congress than it is supporting something that the president proposes. And so by getting out in front of it, they can give themselves some cover with Republican constituents in their states that they're behind something that they're proposing as opposed to being behind something that the president is backing.
And what's your sense then, if you can unpick the politics of this for us, is there any way that Obama may try and sort of engage with that agenda that was mooted yesterday, or is this one of these things where he wants to be seen to be being very statesmanlike, to be doing his own thing? Is there any sense of how he might choose to move from here, sticking with his own initiatives or trying to engage with what we heard yesterday?
You know, I think that he's going to speak of this. He'll likely make reference to what came out yesterday as almost a good start. Much of what was proposed yesterday is sort of what the president is behind and what he favors. There's some elements of it, though, that he in the past has not been for. A key plank of that that Republicans had pushed was not allowing the path to citizenship to start until the border is secured. But, you know, who necessarily gets to decide how the border is secured is sort of left open for debate, perhaps leaving any of these paths to citizenship open for questions for years down the road. That's not something that the president is going to be for. He's going to be looking for much more immediate action. And he's also, you know, in a position of strength at this point on this issue, given the margins that he put up among Hispanic voters during the election. And Republicans know that, and they know that they have to do something to help stem the tide for them to do better among Hispanic voters in the upcoming election.
Now, I wanted to ask you about that specifically. Obviously, we looked in great detail at that around the time of the Obama success, how significant this lack of support amongst the Hispanic vote was for the Republicans. Is there some cynicism here? Is it just an easy device to be making the right noises, to be striking a more conciliatory tone now about the immigration issue? Do you think the American public are naive enough to actually fall for that, if that is what's happening indeed?
Well, I would never hold the American public as not naive enough to fall for something. but, you know, these politicians act in their own self-interest. In general, they do what they think will get them reelected based on their constituents. And immigration reform was never going to happen until Republicans deemed it necessary, essentially for their own political survival. And they have a lot of ground to make up among Hispanic voters, and the demographics in this country show that the Hispanics are the fastest growing part of the electorate, the fastest growing part of the population. And Republicans know that if they don't do something to help themselves there, they could be doomed to irrelevance for generations to come. And so they're, even though they've gotten a bit of a late start on this, they're doing the best they can to make up.
And I wanted to just ask you about the Republican movement then looking ahead. You've got the likes of Marco Rubio involved with this sort of affiliation of senators who made their pronouncements yesterday. How much do you think he and other, I guess, potential candidates to be leading that Republican charge by the time of the next big election, how sensitive are they to shifting their rhetoric from some of the more aggressive and hard-line positions that we heard, certainly in the build-up to the last presidential race? Do you think that they have really acknowledged that the time has come for them to strike a more conciliatory tone? And will we see even someone like Rubio, you know, a potential leader of that charge, adopting a more gentle and centrist rhetoric when discussing this issue?
I think we've already seen that, you know, from Rubio is, you know, talks about how some of the more extreme elements of the party are not necessarily where it needs to be when they speak about deporting the estimated 11 million undocumented people in this country. He and most people in this country, most people in Washington realize that that's sort of an untenable thing. It's not going to happen. But there's a good part of the base of the Republican Party that feels that that's necessary before any immigration reform can go forward. And so it's going to be up to people like Rubio and John McCain, who's involved in this, to explain to their constituents and explain to Republicans that that is something that is not going to happen. But the way that the American political system is set up now, many of these elected officials in Washington are just as responsive to the fringe elements or the extremes of their party as they are to the center, because that's the way the primary system is set up there, just as if not more important for their reelection than sort of the broad center of the country.
And Reid, just finally, looking ahead then, we'll have Obama's speech. What happens to Obama if he can't get any traction for his vision to settle this problem? Where will he go if he isn't able? He's made it one of the key strands of his second term. What happens if he can't get this done?
Well, that's sort of the $64,000 question now. You know, Obama has immigration, he has gun control, and he has the economy are the three big things he's going to be pushing in the next 6 months or so at the beginning of his second term. And it's not clear that he can get enough Republican cooperation to push any more than the minimum on any of those issues. And so what we may see is just a sort of a continuation of his presidential campaign on these particular issues. He's set up a separate political arm to raise money in order to do that. And the thinking is that he's going to continue to campaign around the country as if he were still a candidate in advance of the 2014 midterm elections, in hopes to seize a Democratic majority in Congress in order to push through his initiatives in the last 2 years of his term.
That was Reid Epstein, White House correspondent for Politico, speaking to me a little earlier. Coming up, we'll find out what impact an increasingly powerful China is having on their neighbour.
Sichuan was one of China's poorest provinces until investment from Beijing and abroad brought boom time to its capital. Monocle's video journalist Gabriel Li paid a visit to Chengdu to gauge the progress.
Here the changes are radical. This has become a much more international city, and every day you see it growing more and more. This is the new market inside of China, which is it's not a market itself, it's a continent. Foreign companies that want to sell something in China, now they're trying to come here. And you can see they're coming here.
Chengdu, the new China, in the films menu on Monocle.com.
The menu is Monocle 24's weekly look at good food, great drinks, and the makers behind these experiences. Each week we serve up the latest in cuisine around the world, from top chefs to tiny breweries, and of course, the best baristas.
Coffees that really stand out, that jump off the table, is what we're always looking for.
On the latest edition, we find out about the merits of urban beekeeping in Berlin. We visit an area of Seoul that has shaken its criminal reputation to become a hotspot for international restaurants. And we talk about a new trend, which has people pairing their hot dogs with a glass of champagne.
Champagne goes very well with fatty food because the acidity of champagne cuts through the fat content and it's extremely satisfying.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
You're listening to Midori House. Now, we'll be exploring China's long-term global vocation later in the show, but now we're going to look at Russia and the impact that their upwardly mobile neighbour in the East is having on the former superpower. Ben Judah, who's travelled extensively in the region, has written about Russian perceptions of China, particularly with regard to the state of Siberia and the borderlands between the two countries. Many analysts and academics, not to mention a good number of imaginative novelists, have some pretty grave visions of the future for Russia's Asian East. But are their worries and some of the more fanciful imaginings of the writers well-founded or really based more in myth? Well, Ben Judah is here with me in the studio now to try and help answer that. Ben, thanks for coming on
to
Midori House. So I guess that's where I wanted to start, really, by asking you about this kind of fear, national fear in Russia. Do you think that there is a worry that subservience to China is in some ways the kind of contemporary nightmare for Russia?
Well, Putin likes to say that Russia needs 20 years of state building, but the joke is that Russia needs 20 years of psychoanalysis. And there's been a change in the past 4 or 5 years in Russia about what Russia fears the most. At the beginning of Putin's rule, the main fear was really Islam, was that Russia was going to have a kind of Yugoslavianization. There were going to be full-on Muslim-Christian wars up the Volga, spreading from Chechnya. And as Putin's stability stabilized, but also became kind of more ramshackle and corrupt, the financial crisis tipped the fear into a new fear, which is that of China. And ever since about 2008, especially in the intellectual class, the big nightmare is that the only existential threat to Russia, apart from, of course, American nuclear weapons, is that corrupt, porous borders in Siberia and the Far East will see lots of Chinese seep over, gradually colonizing, buying all the resources, until one day Russians will wake up and discover that Russia is like an illusion of empire, and that beyond the Urals, they may formally be in control, but actually it will be under Chinese economic sovereignty.
I mean, do you think then there's a shift in rhetoric now as people become maybe slightly more cynical about Putin and some of his language on this subject, that people will start to focus more then on the threat, or a perceived threat perhaps, of a kind of, I think you describe it as a US-Chinese bipolarity, something like where the entire balance shifts towards how the US and China are engaging in this kind of awkward diplomacy?
Well, Putin, after the Iraq war, became convinced that the US was going to enter into long-term decline. And he felt very bitter that Russia was never invited to join NATO. And he decided in about 2003 that he was going to pivot to Asia before anyone else. He hasn't really visited the US majorly since about 2003. He goes very regularly to Beijing. His daughter, I think this is very revealing about Putin's view of the world, was taught Chinese, is alleged to speak fluent Chinese and Korean. And Putin has ordered that the Russian Foreign Ministry devote more and more time to working on China. And the reason is that Putin dreams that China in the 21st century can play the role, Russia in the 21st century can play the role that China played during the Cold War, of balancing between the two superpowers and kind of gaining advantage from that. And lots of Russian intellectuals are very frightened that if Russia doesn't seize that chance, Russia will become a kind of irrelevant player in global politics. And everything will be decided by Beijing and Washington, and Moscow will be as kind of as irrelevant as Manila as to deciding the fate of the Pacific.
So having then visited some of these places in the east of Russia, what are your impressions? Because I know there is obviously, you were quite struck by the sheer kind of numbers imbalance, if you like, population-wise. But then anecdotally, your experience on the ground is very different. And in fact, there's not these seas, there's not this kind of menace from China that the rhetoric would have you believe. How different is it on the ground from what the sort of worst doom mongers say in Moscow?
Well, I'll tell you first why I decided to go. And I think anyone who is interested in China or has spent time in China becomes obsessed by numbers. 1.5 billion Chinese, 1 billion consumers, millions of yuan, trillions of dollars. And I became obsessed about two numbers, which is the population of the Russian Far East is 6.5 million and falling, and the population of the free Chinese border provinces are 100 million and rising. And I couldn't get these numbers out of my head, and I couldn't stop imagining that border as a dike holding off potential seas. And as I kind of made my way around Moscow, interviewing people and foreign policy experts, I kept on asking, like, what? Since we know that the bureaucracy and the rest of Russia is so corrupt, how can we be sure that those border guards aren't terribly corrupt? And no one could give me a kind of straight answer. Lots of people would simply go, yeah, they're definitely colonising. It's definitely happening. Russia won't be sovereign over this area in 10 or 15 years. It's terrible. Like, Russia is over. So I had to go. And I picked, the region I picked to go to is called Birobidzhan. And Birobidzhan is the capital of a territory called the Jewish Autonomous Republic, which is because Stalin had decided this would be Soviet farmland for the Jews. So that obviously failed. And it's taken on a new lease of life as the province that Russians most associate with China, because 14% of its territory has been leased to Beijing for farming. So I decided that to go to this province and see if what was happening there was the beginning of a Chinese takeover of Siberia, or if in the kind of grand scheme of things it wasn't really very much. What I found was that there are practically no Chinese in Birobidzhan city and in all the major Russian cities of the Far East. There are some markets, but there are no Chinatowns, and all of these cities are way whiter, dare I say, than probably any city in the European Union. And the only areas where I found Chinese, if I drove down to the actual borderlands, there were farmlands, but the people farming them were not settlers. These were kind of contract workers living in bases. They weren't allowed out. They were terrified of Russians. They didn't speak a word of Russian. They had absolutely no desire to stay. They were all men. And the people who'd come there were really people who'd failed to find jobs in the big Chinese coastal cities and had failed to make it anywhere else a Chinese person might possibly want to go. And I'm thinking, in Indonesia, Thailand, all of these areas are large Chinese diaspora communities. And the men running these farms, they told me that it was a pretty difficult job because people just didn't want to come. Because Russia was way worse living environment than northern China these days. And China had a big labour shortage. And it was becoming increasingly expensive to get people. And a lot of the independent farmers I met were actually kind of pulling up shop.
Well, I was going to ask you about this because, again, you suggest from the sort of anecdotal evidence that, in fact, from a lot of these Russian businessmen, that they were quite knowing and they understood that, you know, greater Chinese investment was something they would actually welcome. They were wary about increasing protectionism from the Russian government. Do you think that as the reality dawns, we'll see less of this fearfulness, as perhaps, as you suggested in your piece, that in fact many Chinese will have to go back to China to service the demand for labour within Chinese borders?
Well, I think about Russia as a country that needs 20 years of psychoanalysis. I think Russia's future is going to look a lot like its past, in which there's going to be lots of sort of state propaganda based on paranoia. And I think that after a diet of exclusively anti-Western propaganda for the past 50 years, there's going to be a little bit more of a mix in the 21st century of anti-Chinese propaganda on a Tuesday, followed by anti-American stuff on a Wednesday, and some Islamophobic propaganda on a Thursday. But in Vladivostok and Khabarovsk, which are the two major cities in the Russian Far East, people tell you that the colonist, it's not China, it's actually Moscow, it's actually Putin, which is that all of the resources that matter, minerals, diamonds, oil, and of course gas, all of this is extracted by Moscow. It's extracted by oligarchs loyal to Putin, by Putin's state-controlled oil and gas companies. And the local people feel that all this money's been sucked out and they're not really getting anything back, and that a corrupt centre is giving them only the FSB and bad governance, and occasionally they might throw in something like a new road or a new sort of network of primary schools. And there's a big desire in the Russian Far East that Moscow could be a little less controlling, that they could have a little more autonomy over their finances, and that they could have a more normal business relationship with China. And the interesting thing about the Russia-Chinese border is that all over the world we see the global north and the global south are blending. US is blending into Mexico. Europe is blending into Africa and the Arab world. China is blending into Thailand and Indonesia, but not on the Russian borderlands. These remain, in a way, iron curtains to migrants.
It's an absolutely fascinating subject. Ben Judah, thanks for joining me in the studio to elaborate it for us. We'll be exploring the nature of China's global expansion plans a bit later in the show. For now, thanks, Ben. We'll be back after this quick break with a look at why the Trevi Fountain is getting a makeover.
If you think the print industry is on its last legs, then you haven't tuned into The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly review of the best in paper, ink, varnishes, and glue. Every Saturday morning, we sit down with an informed group of editors, journalists, art directors, and photographers to flip through their favorite periodicals.
There's a huge amount of arrogance going into this, but it's got confidence and pride, and that makes for a fantastic end result.
It's a matter of pride to be involved in certain magazines. It's not about the reach and numbers, it's about the reach and quality.
Matte or glossy, saddle stitched or perfect bound, The Stack is an hour of opinions, predictions, and proclamations about all the titles we hoard, archive, and savour.
There is a real difference, and the difference will become more sharply edged as time goes on.
The biggest breakfast buffet of magazines and newspapers is served up every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brûlé, and a passionate mix of print aficionados.
I think it's real when it's ink. You can take it home and it doesn't flicker.
Now, the Trevi Fountain has an unlikely new benefactor, Fendi's Fashion House. No, it doesn't mean it's going to be reupholstered in brown leather with gold buckles. Fendi is financing a 2.18 million euro restoration of the feature. They aren't the first fashion brand to fund Rome's heritage. The founder of Tod's is footing the bill for the 25 million euro restoration of the Colosseum. So why does the fashion industry care so much about Rome's ancient monuments? Well, a little earlier, Robert Bound spoke to Monocle's Milan correspondent Ivan Carvalho to find out more.
When was this announced that Fendi and Karl Lagerfeld were going to be putting the money up to put the Trevi Fountain back together again?
Yeah, this is a recent thing. You had mentioned the Tod's sponsoring for the restoration work on the Colosseum, which happened finally this year. It was going to happen last year, but there was a bit of wrangling because the consumer group said there was no open bidding and they were worried about big advertising on the monument. But actually, in the case of the Tod's luxury group, there won't be any of these massive billboards. They're just going to have the right to use the logo of the Colosseum on the ticket, so people, when they arrive, they'll be able to use it in that way and other ways, but it won't be a big, massive billboard. Fendi's case, they're going to put that billboard up covering the scaffolding. And for Fendi, you know, they're based in Rome, so for them it's a good tie-in, and it, of course, is one of the most popular places for tourists, so they're thinking it's going to be an excellent return for bringing in shoppers to their boutiques.
And presumably for Fendi, it's a nice goodwill gesture. They get their hoarding up, as you say, around the building work. And it's only 2 million euros as well. It's there's not many maybe right-hand facing pages of the International Herald Tribune that you'd get for that sort of money anyway, right?
I believe it's a very good deal because the traffic that goes through that place all day, because everybody knows the Trevi Fountain from of course, the film La Dolce Vita and that night bath by Anita Ekberg. So tourists go there all the time. Unfortunately, some of the tourists are a bit rambunctious and get into the fountain, try to take off pieces of the fountain of the stone. And so that's, of course, one of the reasons why they need to restore it. Like a lot of monuments, there's a bit of wear and tear because tourists are trotting through, like, say, in Pompeii, when people actually take some stones back as mementos, and this has been seen in airports when they're doing checks of bags. So Italy has a lot of monuments, 47 UNESCO World Heritage Sites, so they need to be upkept, and in times of austerity, money is not there from the state.
And you could almost say that the Trevi Fountain could pay for itself. There are apparently almost 1.5 million euros worth of coins chucked in the fountain every year for good luck purposes. What happens to these, Ivan, in the end?
There are lots of interesting stories about that. There's a gentleman that usually collects some of this of these coins. People dive in. An artist has actually dyed the fountain several several times. Some people are claiming that he was trying to get some of the money from out of there. They've never actually used a ticket, any kind of system to cordon off the fountain to bring through people, just because of the location. It's very tight in that square. So I think with this Fendi solution, and you're probably going to see more of these agreements because the fashion houses have money and they're willing to put it up the funds to support restoration works.
That was Monocle's man in Milan, Ivan Carvalho, talking to Robert Bound. Now, in the next half hour of the programme, we'll speak to the authors of a new book that explores how the Chinese are slowly remaking the world in Beijing's image. We'll also take a trip to the world's largest confectionery fair and find out how much country's cultural capital can even influence the type of dog you own. But before all that, here's Paul Osborne with the news headlines.
Activists say the bodies of dozens of young men who had apparently been executed have been found in the Syrian city of Aleppo. At least 65 were discovered on the banks of a river. Most had their hands tied behind their backs. French-led forces in Mali are preparing for an assault on the last rebel stronghold in the north of the country, Kidal. Yesterday, they took control of Timbuktu alongside Malian troops. International donors, meanwhile, have pledged hundreds of millions of dollars to boost efforts to tackle Islamist militants in Mali. President Obama is joining efforts to push through changes in U.S. immigration law. He's to set out a plan which could mean millions gain American citizenship the day after a bipartisan group of senators said it was the right time for reform. Meanwhile, the U.S. Senate committee has unanimously backed John Kerry as the next Secretary of State. It's thought his formal confirmation as Hillary Clinton's successor will follow within hours. And the head of Egypt's army has warned the country is on the brink of collapse after days of violence and political unrest in which at least 52 people have died. Abdel Fattah al-Sisi was speaking after 5 days of at times violent protest against the president, Mohamed Morsi. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, coming to you live from London.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokiost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Now, a little earlier in the show, we were talking about the perceptions of Chinese expansion from within Russia. It's time to cast the net a good deal wider now. The journalists and authors Juan Pablo Cardinal and Heriberto Araujo have a new book, China's Silent Army, published in English on the last day of January. In it, they document their travels to meet some of the many Chinese who are, in the words of their subtitle, remaking the world in Beijing's image. So what are the implications of the phenomena they identify in the book? And how concerned are they by the engagement, or lack of it, from the rest of the world with the key problems they identify? Juan Pablo, Heriberto, welcome to Midori House. Before we get started, I wanted to just ask you briefly how you came to write this book. I guess it's an obvious question. Successful journalists, what made you decide to pursue this particular sort of angle of engagement?
Hello, good afternoon. Well, we were at the end of 2009, we were sharing office in Beijing, and we realized that, first of all, writing about China's GDP was becoming a little bit boring. On the other hand, we realized that there was the real news about China was happening outside China. But about those all those Chinese investments and loans that we were seeing every day on the internet and on newspapers, small pieces of information, there was always a huge figure behind it. And there was all this win-win situation rhetoric by Chinese authorities or the authorities in the recipient countries, but no information of what was happening on the ground, what was happening to the people that were supposedly benefiting out of those investments. And we thought, well, this is real journalism. Let's go and talk to the people. Let's go on the ground. Let's see it with our own eyes and see what is really happening in this Chinese world expansion.
That's well, we're big fans of real journalism, so you're in the right place. And I just wondered then, since the publication of the Spanish edition of your book, has the fact that the financial crisis around the world, it's continued, in some respects deepened, has that raised your confidence that the sort of diagnosis you made in the book in Spanish was actually correct? Do you feel like it's, you know, you're more right than ever now?
Yes, I mean, the Chinese financial strength, you know, all these financial resources that China has in this context of crisis, it's the driver of Chinese expansion. This is why all the countries are engaging with China, because China is financing, constructing, and bringing in labor force for the Chinese projects, infrastructure projects. And on the other hand, China is giving all those loans and starting all those projects in the extractive industry, thanks to all these financial resources that seems that other countries don't have, you know.
Now, I wanted to ask you about the sort of impact of this in the developing world. I think you call it where the giant's footprint is most visible. What's the kind of damage, Heriberto, that sort of China Inc., as it's called, can do in these countries? How would you characterize the kind of problems that we see in places where we've seen this kind of expansion from China?
I think that our research shows, after going to over 25 countries and you know, do over 500 interviews, it shows a clear picture of what's going on in field. And we were kind of surprised, I have to admit, even if we are both China-based journalists, to witness how the problems of the side effects of this China growth, even in China, is actually being exported abroad. So what you can read in our book is that all those investments and loans and all those infrastructures are a great opportunity, potential opportunity, and the elites, the economical elites and the political elites of those recipient countries are engaging very much with China, and this is, we find it kind of normal. But when you go to the people to ask them, you know, when you ask the miners in Zambia, when you ask the miners in Peru, when you ask the workers who are the local workers working for Chinese state-owned companies in Mozambique, you know, building a stadium, you ask them, is this an opportunity for you? Is this an opportunity for development? And we were quite surprised to see, and this is what we have, I think, explained in the book, that some of those people sometimes get very angry against China because they believe they are simply, you know, being imposed a system of work sometimes or wages in which they don't agree. So I would say there are mixed feelings, you know, towards this Chinese engagement with the developing world.
Because it's very affecting, I must say, in the book. There's a lot of personal stories, that kind of testimony, which obviously is very impactful. And I think it helps to make the case. Some of the examples in Peru, people talking about their town feeling sort of colonialized and a new colonialism. And some really sort of heartbreaking detail. Is it Boten in Laos, where there's some parodies, you say, or equivalencies between the worst excesses of some of the sort of colonialist abuse of China from the 1800s. Is there a sense, Juan Pablo, that that's the real truth of this, that maybe isn't out there, and that you need books like yours to tell to the world?
I mean, we don't deny all the positive aspects of this, of what China is doing in the developing world, and it's, of course, it's a legitimate approach that China has. But what we, as I was saying at the beginning, there's a gap in between what it is said officially and what is happening on the ground. And what we, I think, the one of the values of this research and of this book is going there and realize that although there's many positive aspects to it, there's also many that have to do with the low standards in terms of environmental issues or labor conditions or social standards. And this is what is, this gap is what we think we fill in when we did this research.
Now, there's a telling quote at the start of the epilogue to your book from Deng Xiaoping in the 1970s about a cautionary note: China must never be a superpower, and encouraging the world to intervene if that ever happens. Do you think, with your experience as having worked extensively in China and then seen how this is played out around the world, is there anyone in Beijing who
still feels that way or is concerned about what the implications of being the new superpower might be?
Yes, I think the Chinese government and Chinese officials, they really understand what does it mean to be a global superpower. And I would say this is kind of normal because China has been for centuries a global superpower. And as one of the sources of the book explain us, and I think this is a great idea, is that Chinese people and even Chinese government is perceiving this China growth issue as a normal, as a, something that should be normal, because they're simply getting back to the original situation in which they were in the 18th century. So yes, my perception is that Beijing is more and more assertive, and you have this feeling when you've been living in China, in my case, for over 6 years, and you also have this feeling when you go abroad and you see how global is this Chinese engagement with the developing world.
And just finally, Juan Pablo, I wanted to ask you about the kind of balance that's being struck from certain Western powers with China, particularly in terms of some of the kind of market-driven things we've seen, China buying into, you know, big celebrated brands in the West, buying into public infrastructure projects, this kind of thing. Do you think that the countries in the West have the balance right? Are you concerned that it's too good an opportunity to turn down when there's this kind of investment from China? Or does it blind them to some of the worst excesses, if you like?
Well, we are now working on a second book, which is China's approach to the West. And we've seen a lot of what you're saying. We were recently in Canada, for instance, that has Canada's partner throughout history has been the United States, but now it's in this diversification strategy, and they are willing to sell their oil production to China. So, for instance, one of the things that happened is that they have completely dropped the human rights issue off the agenda. Why is this? Because the perception, both in the developing world and the developed world, is that China is the country that is going to get us out of the crisis. And this is, of course, because of all these financial resources that they have.
It's a fascinating subject, and I think you'll have to come back and tell us about the findings of your next book on Midori House. Juan Pablo Heriberto, thank you very much for joining us. The book is China's Silent Army, and it's published by Allen Lane. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be right back after this with a visit to the world's largest sweets and biscuits fair.
The Entrepreneurs is about the movers and shakers, the lone rangers, the innovators, the modern mercantile mavericks, and the venerable merchandisers. It's Monocle 24's weekly business show. Every week, we seek out the startups, the brands on the make, and the leaders of global business empires doing things differently.
Assume you don't know the answer. If you assume that, you have to start creating options for yourself.
From master cobblers to asset managers, from impresarios in the luxury yacht sector to tech startups shaking up Silicon Valley. Tune in on Wednesdays at 1900 hours London time or download the show on Monocle 24's website.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
From a breed of Italian sheep brought back from extinction to vintage recipes revitalizing the dairy business in a remote part of Norway, Monocle Films brings you inspiring tales of mountain producers on a mission.
Mikhail's restaurants depend on locally sourced produce for its recipes, which have attracted a faithful following. It's proof, if ever proof were needed, that when restaurants work in collaboration with local food producers, it's possible to make a sustainable business out of organic farming and to create a distinct regional culinary identity.
Making it work in the mountains on monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House. The time is 1843 here in London. Now, for all you sweet tooths out there, this next story is sure to delight. Happening now, more than 1,400 suppliers from around the world are gathered in Cologne at the annual International Sweet and Biscuit Fair. sounds delicious. It's the largest gathering of candy makers, chocolate producers and biscuit makers in the world. Well, joining us now for an update on just how sweet life is there is Philip Claymire, marketing manager of Lap and Fowl Chocolates. Hello, Philip. Thanks for joining us on Midori House. I just wanted to ask you, as a veteran of the fair, what exactly does it offer to businesses like yours? Why is it such an important event?
Well, it's the most important fair such for the chocolate and candy industry. And as we're very strong in the chocolates, it's our main focus to have this fair attended. And we have a lot of different clients coming to this fair. And so it's an absolute must for us to attend.
And now tell me, Philip, when I speak to people from trade fairs recently, there's a lot of concern about how the markets are shaping up and whether people are reining back their spending. What's your verdict in this sort of sweet-toothed section of business? Are things looking bright for the rest of 2013?
Well, there's a big competition, of course, and we have hard times in the past as well. But if you have your gap, you have to you can close with your product. It's a chance. So you always have a chance to offer something special, and that's what we are trying to do.
So tell me then, Philip, what are the special things on offer? What any new trends that I need to know about as a fan, particularly of chocolate?
Well, we see that a lot of companies that we didn't see in the past are coming back. So we have a lot of local producers, small family-run businesses that, as the fair offers a special newcomer area with lower prices to attend the fair, they are coming back, and we are in the kind of business where we are not the biggest company, but we have a lot of fans around Germany, and that's what you have to do.
Now, I know that Lap and Fowl is very much about handmade chocolates, you know, the real skilled chocolatiers. It's smaller factories, none of this sort of massive production lines. Do you think that within the sector more broadly, that's what people really value? They're still happy to pay a premium, you know, to get the very best, to get the handmade products, to get the things that have been really made with a bit of extra care and attention?
Yeah, that's true. And in our case, people sometimes remember us because Lap and Fowl was actually a small deli in Hamburg. It's about 15 years ago, but that closed after 3 years, and we were able to follow up with a chocolate brand. And so people come to us and say, "Oh, that's something I know from years before," and we're really happy to see you back again. And so there's a real heritage to it, and that's what we see at the fair as such, that there's a lot of nostalgia and heritage going on. Companies are looking into their own history and try to show that to people.
Now, Philip, tell me a little bit about what the fair is actually like, because to my mind, my vivid imagination, I hear about 1,400 suppliers of chocolates and biscuits. It sounds like something from, Willy Wonka's factory. Is it a mad, incredible place with people running around eating everything they can get their hands on, or is everyone actually rather well behaved?
No, it's pretty crowded and a lot of talks you have to do, and the people are very, very busy all the time, but sometimes you find a quiet place, you can talk to smaller firms and have a little chat. And so within the years, you know each other. And I have the gist that people really, really like it and have it like a meeting point. So, of course, it's busy and there's people who are a bit annoying, but most of them are actually quite nice.
Well, that's good news. Just finally, Philip, I wondered, any particular things that have stood out for you? Have you sampled any wares and you've thought, wow, I wonder how they make this? Or any particular ones that you think are going to really become big products, big breakout products for 2013?
Well, what I don't really like, I have to say in the opposite way, is there's a lot of producers for stevia. It's this product for substitute for sugar, which I don't really like. I always say if you want to treat yourself with chocolate, you don't need an additive which is not sugar itself. Product wise, what I think is quite funny that there's a lot of popcorn coming back. I mean, popcorn I always liked, and in different forms it's coming back. And also the cake pops. It's like a lollipop with a cake on top, so, you know, a wooden stick.
Wow.
And you have a cake on top. That's actually quite a nice product I saw.
That sounds absolutely superb. Well, I'll be putting my orders in right now. Philip Claymire, Marketing Manager of Lap and Fowl Chocolate, thanks very much for joining us from the International Sweets and Biscuit Fair. Now, Omidori House, to get us in the mood for our next story, here's Florence and the Machine with Dog Days Are Over. That was Florence and the Machine with Dog Days Are Over. Now, on Midori House, we're going to be asking that very question. Are dog days indeed over? The summer of 2012 was a summer that celebrated all things British. Millions lined the streets for a four-day party to mark Queen Elizabeth's Jubilee. Millions more came to take part in a month of sport during the Olympic and Paralympic Games. The very British of parties made such an impact, it even influenced people's buying habits when it comes to dogs. According to the Kennel Club, there was a surge of interest in British dog breeds after the Olympic Games. The number of English setter puppies registered increased by 25%, and there was a 7% increase in the number of old English sheepdogs. Well, joining me now on the line to discuss this further is Bill Lambert, Health and Breeder Services Manager from the UK Kennel Club, and Monocle's editor and dog owner, Wirehead Fox Terrier connoisseur, I should say, Andrew Tuck, joins me in the studio. Thanks both for joining us on Midori House. Bill, if I can come to you first of all, how much of a crisis were some of these traditional English breeds in then before the summer?
Well, it's interesting, Tom. There's quite a few breeds that are on our what we call our vulnerable breed list. When their numbers drop to registering less than 300 each year, so that's 300 new puppies each year, when they drop below that number, we start to have a look and try and look at these breeds and sort of spotlight them, really, to bring them to people's attention. And for a number of years, we've had a lot of our traditional breeds, a lot of our terrier breeds in particular, have fallen below this 300 number. Now, we had seen two particular breeds, the two that you mentioned, the English setter and the old English sheepdog, which are really well-known breeds, drop into that category or drop towards that category. And last year we did see a bit of a bounce back. And we have wondered, as you said in your introduction, if this has been really as a factor of the Jubilee year, the Queen's Jubilee and the Olympics, everybody focusing on Britain and they want to identify with Britain.
But without getting too graphic, how quickly can you turn the numbers around? Because I was surprised that suddenly you could have this huge leap in the number of puppies. Is it just that, you know, literally you kind of, there is a demand, so suddenly the kind of dogs are set to, as it were?
Well, yes, you're right to highlight it. I mean, you can't breed dogs to order, as it were, you know, and you may have had people who had just chosen not to breed for a few years, who had breeding animals, who had chosen not to, but because there was a demand, they thought, well, I'll have a litter this year, I missed out a couple of years and I'm going to have a litter this year. Or they may have had puppies that have grown up into adult dogs now that they decide to breed from. So you're absolutely right, you can't, and this is one of the fantastic thing about purebred dogs is, of course, it's such a variety. There is literally a dog out there for everyone. We have seen over the years that some of the larger breeds have started to drop in numbers as people have started to go for some of the smaller breeds. And we do see trends in dog ownership. You see things like celebrity often influences people's choices. And that's not necessarily the right reason to buy a dog.
Now, Bill, I'm a big fan of Wirehead Fox Terriers, family connection, you might say. And Andrew here has actually recently acquired one of these fine animals. But I gather that the smooth Fox Terrier, the cousin of the Wirehead, that's one of the dogs that's really endured a really drastic drop. What do you think can be done to stop these declining demand for some of these very traditional and classic English dogs?
Well, it's an interesting point because it's always puzzled me. Last year, we registered between six and 700 wire fox terriers, and yet the smooth fox terrier we only registered 94 last year. Now, it has puzzled me because they are very similar dogs with lots of similar characteristics, and arguably the wire fox terrier is perhaps more difficult simply because it has a coat that has to be trimmed from time to time. So actually, to me, it makes no sense that one dog should be more popular than the other, and I think it has to be down to appearance. People perhaps prefer the the wire coat. They've got a real cheeky look, I think. And people often describe them as looking like a little old man with a beard. And I think they're great dogs. In fact, I'm a great terrier fan myself. And the terrier breeds have been some of our declining breeds. And I think one of the reasons is you have to look at the reason why dogs people had traditionally had dogs, particularly the terriers. They were often kept, you know, for vermin control, for killing rats and mice. And of course, we perhaps don't have, we don't, you know, control rats and mice in those traditional ways anymore. So the demand for that type of dog has left us a little bit. We've also seen an increase in the number of breeds. We in the last 50 odd years, we registered, you know, another 50 breeds. We've increased the number of breeds. Well, you know, from, and they've cut, a lot of them coming from countries, you know, overseas. So we see more dogs like the Shih Tzu, the Bichon Frise, and these have become very much companion dogs and taken the place, perhaps, of some of our traditional terriers.
Belka, could you, apart from pointing out, I think that the terrier also ignores you most of the time and does the opposite to what you tell her, apart from that. And just tell me, culturally, do you think that we, when you go to other countries, that you also see these, you know, that people are quite nationalistic about their dog breeds?
To an extent, they are. I mean, they are great. Some dogs are a great sign of Britain. Bulldogs, for example, they've increased in popularity over recent years, but they're very much a sign of Britain, the bulldog spirit, of course. But yes, you do. We have. Typically, some breeds are more popular in their country of origin, and the terriers are particularly a dog in this country that we are obviously a nation of dog lovers, but terriers are very much a British dog. But yes, you do see popularity in other countries reflected in their choice of dog ownership. German shepherd dogs are immensely popular in Germany, for example.
Bill, we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks very much for joining us here on Midori House. That's all we've got time for, I'm afraid, today. Thanks to our producer, Phil Han, our researcher, Fernando Pacheco, and of course, our studio manager, Alex Funnell. Next up on Monocle 24 is Section D. Have a great afternoon.